Okay, so it's late, so I guess I'll start with a mic story. So mine actually happened in this very room like 2 years ago. And Dorit Aharonov was giving a talk about, an introductory talk about quantum computing. And she was talking about what is the CNOT gate, what's the Hadamard gate. And Mike sort of leaned over to me and said, you know, gates are really just, you know, low-level programming, right? There's not really anything interesting to say here, right? And I said, all right, I can give you something interesting, right? And I mentioned this problem of can you classify... could there be a set of quantum gates which cannot be used to build a universal quantum computer, but also cannot be simulated efficiently by a classical computer? Is there an intermediate set of gates? That's actually an open problem to this day. Okay, so then for the next like 10 minutes, he's just leaning over to me, furiously whispering, you know, all of his ideas of how to solve this problem, until eventually I realized we should probably go out in the hall so we don't disrupt the whole talk. But I guess my point is that if Mike leans over to you and says that there's nothing interesting about my talk, then this might be the start of something important. So, okay. So, all right, so I'm going to talk about quantum computing with non-interacting bosons. This is joint work with my student, Alex Arkhipov. And this talk will actually involve two topics in which Mike has played a pioneering role. The first I would call quantum computing beyond qubits. Okay, so, Dorit and my story was talking about, you know, controlled knot, Hadamard gates, right? This is the standard sort of circuit or qubit-based way of looking at quantum computing, but we've already heard a lot in this workshop about some alternative ways to do quantum computation. For example, using topological quantum field theories, using non-abelian anions. We now know that these models are actually equivalent to the standard quantum circuit model. One nice thing is that this yields all sorts of new links between complexity and physics, as we've seen. So if the circuit model is too simple for you, it doesn't have enough categories in it, or modular functors, you know, that problem can be solved, right? These sort of alternate paradigms can give you new proposals for how you would implement a quantum computer, okay? Which maybe would have better fault tolerance or better this or that. Okay, and in this talk, we're going to talk about another alternative quantum computing model. This one, as far as we know, is actually not universal. Okay, so like the one clean qubit model that Peter Shor talked about, this one may well be intermediate between classical and quantum computation. Okay, the other theme is quantum computing and the complexity class sharp P of counting problems. Okay, we saw that Mike wrote this influential paper about these two topics in 98. And, you know, in particular, pointing out like the Jones polynomial, for example, is sharp P complete to compute exactly. It's as hard as any counting problem, right? And yet, quantum computers can additively estimate its value at roots of unity, right? So somehow they get sort of just on the cusp of sharp. So some, it seems, of solving a sharp P complete problem, but then they don't. You know, to actually solve a sharp P complete problem with a quantum computer would be sort of, you know, many of us believe too amazing to be true. Okay, and it seems to fall short of that. And so what's up with this, right? That quantum computing can sort of do sharp P, but not quite. All right. So in this talk, I'm going to try to tell you what's up with it. Okay. So all right. So let's start with the extended Church Turing thesis. And this is like a foundational belief of theoretical computer science since the 1960s. And one way to say it is just that everything which is feasibly computable in the physical world by any realistic computing device should also be feasibly computable by a conventional Turing machine. So let's say maybe a probabilistic one. So say in some complexity class, like probabilistic polynomial time. Okay, we all know that 17 years ago, P Peter Shor issued a severe challenge to this thesis. So these are cracks in the foundations of computing. They're not horns. Some people ask that, but okay. So all right. But you know, on the other hand, we also know several things about Shor's algorithm. One is that building a quantum computer that can factor large numbers, like larger than 15, for example, seems to be damn hard. Right? Maybe we could do 21 today, but. A universal quantum computer compared to what physicists know today, is a fairly exotic physical system, right? It has all of this fault tolerance going on. We believe it ought to be possible eventually to build it, But it's certainly beyond present-day technology. Okay, and so you might ask, can't we, like as computer scientists, sort of meet the physicists halfway on this one? Okay, and what do I mean by that? I mean, find some system, some quantum system, which is more accessible to current experiments, but where we can also argue for the hardness of simulating it with a classical computer. Okay, something which has a more physics-y flavor. The other thing we know is that sort of factoring is a very special problem. Okay, we certainly don't think that it's NP complete, for example. Okay, and in fact, there are some people who've maybe just to be contrarian, but they've said that they think that there's a fast classical factoring algorithm. Okay, certainly there could be one without causing any collapse of complexity classes or anything dramatic like that. It would just mean factoring was easy. Okay, so if we want to sort of have evidence that quantum computers can do something faster than classical ones, sort of can we base it on something which is more generic than the factoring problem? Okay, so in this talk we're going to try to address both of these points. My starting point is going to be two central functions for computational complexity in particular, and these are the determinant and the permanent of an n by n matrix. Okay, these are their definitions, and you can see that they differ in just one thing, that the determinant has these minus signs in it, and the permanent doesn't. Okay, and but one thing that computer scientists have known since the 70s, at least, is that one little difference, that stupid minus sign, seems to make an enormous difference for the computational complexity of these two problems. Okay, in particular, the determinant is computable in P. You just use Gaussian elimination, for example. Okay, whereas Valiant proved in the 70s that the permanent is sharp P complete. Okay, so essentially that means it's sort of as hard as any other problem that involves summing an exponential number of terms. Okay, and some of you may know Valiant won the Turing Award a couple months ago. This was one of his great discoveries, I guess. So. Okay, now what makes this even more amazing, to me, is that these two functions turn out to be directly related to the two fundamental types of particle in the universe, which are fermions and bosons. Okay, so this is a picture of some fermions. This is a picture of some bosons. That's the sun. I come from computer science, but I had to learn what these two particles are. Okay, and I'm gonna tell you all about them. So, in particular, if you have n identical fermions and you want to know what's the amplitude for them to sort of transition from some basis state to some other one, turns out you've got to take the determinant of an n by n matrix. Okay, why? Because basically, if they're identical, you've got a sum over n factorial ways of permuting the particles. Okay, each of those permutations contributes an amplitude, and the contribution from each one is just a product of the individual transition amplitudes. Okay, but now fermions have this rule that if you swap two identical ones, then the amplitude for that state of the universe picks up a minus one. Okay, whereas with bosons, you can swap them and nothing happens. Okay, and that's why you get the determinant for one, the permanent for the other. Okay, and Yeah, I guess one point. So these are the two particles. We've heard a lot about non-abelian particles. These are the two abelian particles, I guess, that there are in nature. And one message of this talk is that even abelian particles, so bosons in particular, can already lead to some quite hard problems. Okay. So,
what? Other abelian particles.
Well, all right, in three dimensions, subject to blah 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 theorem of, you know, with such and such conditions, right? At a physics level of rigor. Okay, fine. Okay. Yeah, fine. So, all right. So, I first saw this connection, you know, in a talk that computer scientist Avi Wigderson gave 10 years ago, and he said, look, you know, I don't really understand what fermions or bosons are, but someone told me that there's this connection. It's amazing that these little particles can keep track of these, you know, hard functions. But one thing I can say for sure is the bosons got the harder job between the two. Okay, and so basically what we do in this work is to sort of confirm Avi's joke that yes, indeed, the bosons got the harder job. So let's first talk about the fermionic case. So there was a beautiful result, which was first, you know, as far as I know, first sort of published rigorously by Valiant in a paper in Stock 2001. And in this paper, he was just talking about purely mathematical constructions, what he called match gates. There was no physics involved. Then a year later, Terhal and DiVincenzo wrote a paper basically pointing out that what Valiant had done was to rediscover fermions. And Matt Hastings tells me that the theorem that comes out of this was completely obvious to everyone in folklore and blah blah blah. But all right, this is anyway. This is where I've seen them actually proved. And and basically the conclusion is that if you have a quantum computer and it's built completely out of non-interacting fermions, so fermions with no sort of pairwise interaction, Hamiltonian or force, you know, acting between them, then it can be efficiently simulated by a classical computer. Okay, and essentially the reason for that is that the amplitudes, you know, end up being a sum of squares of determinants, and the determinant is in P, and that gives you the leverage that you need to construct an efficient simulation algorithm. Okay, if you have interacting fermions or interacting bosons, then you should be able to build a universal quantum computer, but here we're just talking about the non-interacting case. Okay, so our result basically says that by contrast, if you have a quantum computer built out of non-interacting bosons, so think photons, for example, I guess you could build a computer out of Higgs bosons or something, but that might be a bit harder. So think of a bunch of non-interacting photons in some optical setup. Then such a machine can solve a sampling problem, so it can sample from a certain probability distribution, which no classical algorithm can efficiently sample from under some plausible assumptions, which I'll get into. Okay, and basically the sampling problem that we're going to solve, one way to state it is you should output a matrix A, an n by n matrix, say, of complex numbers, which should be drawn from the Gaussian distribution, but then weighted by the absolute square of the permanent. Okay, so that the matrices with the Gaussian random matrices with large permanents should be more likely to be drawn from this distribution than the ones with small permanents. Okay, this is an example of a distribution that we can sample from using an optical experiment, but that under some plausible conjectures, we argue is intractable to sample from classically. Okay. All right. So, So I should, you know, address a point. I mean, Peter Shor already talked about this in the beginning of his talk, but in the case of the Jones polynomial, right? But if I'm saying that n boson amplitudes correspond to n by n permanents, I'm also saying that the permanent is sharp P complete. Then doesn't that somehow mean that nature can solve a sharp P complete problem? Right, that would be mind-blowing. Okay, well, you know, that's really too good to be true. And the catch in the argument, as Peter pointed out, is that amplitudes are not directly observable. Okay, an amplitude just gives you the probability that you're going to observe certain outcome, and in cases of interest, these, you know, probabilities might well be exponentially small, which means that to get a decent estimate for the permanent you care about, you might have to repeat the experiment exponentially many times. So then it would be no better than just computing the permanent by classical brute force.
Sorry, Scott, yeah. There was something sort of implicit in what you just said, which was that nature can't solve hard problems either. Is that what you mean to suggest?
Well, I don't believe that nature can solve sharp P complete problems, if that's what you're asking.
Yes,
yes. Right. I mean, I'm willing to bet everything I own on that. Let me put it that way.
Okay. So are you saying, so interacting fermi system? You know,
if nature could immediately reach the ground state, then we know that could solve a sharp P complete problem. But we know of many cases where, you know, nature can get stuck in local optima instead of reaching a global optima.
I mean, like what? Also is not an example, because that's one where we know nature has a hard time finding the answer. But that doesn't answer the question that I asked, which was problems like interacting fermions.
Yes.
That nature solves in a snap.
Oh, well, okay. Well, so what do you mean by hard? Do you mean hard for a classical computer?
Yes.
Oh, well, then we certainly think so. I mean, factoring would be one example, right? And in this talk, I'm going to give another example, okay? So basically, the point is, you know, we have things that are hard for classical computers, like factoring, or like this problem I'm talking about of sampling matrices with large permanents. And these, you know, according to, if quantum mechanics is correct, then nature can solve these problems, right? And hopefully we'll even be able to experimentally demonstrate that someday. Okay, then there's NP-hard problems. Now that's a whole different level of hardness, at least to, you know, a computer scientist, right? And so, you know, to do factoring, and to do an NP-complete problem are two very different things.
Right, so you would say what nature has trouble with also are the NP-hard.
Yes. Yes. Okay, good. Of course it's a belief. Yes. Yes. What I usually say is that if computer scientists had been physicists, we would have long ago declared it a law of nature and just passed Nobel Prizes all around for the, you know, for this amazing discovery. And, you know, because we're, you know, mathematicians, we say, you know, we have to prove it. But I mean, there's, which indeed it's a great question. Yeah. Right. Of course. Yeah. What? Nate, what is that?
Yeah. Nature can solve something that shows a level of arrogance that I find,
even
a theoretical physicist, pretty amazing.
Okay, well, so let me ask you a question. Do you believe that, you know, that are you willing to declare a belief that nature can't send superluminal signals?
I don't know if you, I just wanted to know what.
So let's talk about no superluminal signaling, or about the second law of thermodynamics. Okay. So the point is that, you know, there's a double standard here. I'm sorry, but it just pisses me off. It really pisses me off. Okay? In physics, people, you know, say all kinds of things that aren't proved mathematically. Suddenly, you know, in P versus NP, you know. It's... Okay. So... I mean, the difference is that these things we might be able to prove someday. So, but all right, fine, all right. So, although even then, of course, it will be subject to, you know, our beliefs about what are the laws of physics. Okay, nothing is, you know. All right, fine. So,
all these statements come with what you really mean is efficiently.
Yeah, of course, yes. Right. Nature is solving sharp P-complete problems. You can say they're in polynomial time. Of course, that's what I mean, yes. Okay. So is it, you know, can't we estimate it? It turns out that you know, you can get an estimate using linear optics of the permanent of a matrix, but with some additive error, which scales like the uh, the norm of the matrix to the nth power divided by some polynomial. Okay, now it turns out that if you just want that level of approximation, Leonid Gurvitz gave a beautiful classical randomized polynomial time algorithm that estimates permanent to exactly the same error. Okay, so in this case, linear optics gives you no advantage whatsoever, or the boson computer gives you no advantage at all over what you could do with a classical computer. Okay. In fact, you know, I have a generalization of Gurvitz's result. It was actually from my flight to this conference, which says that actually there's even a polynomial time randomized algorithm to estimate the probability of any final state of a bosonic computer. Okay, which is a more general thing because here we consider states that can have multiple bosons in the same mode. I'll get into that later. To within an additive error, which is certainly at most one over polynomial, and actually the more bosons you have in the same state, actually the approximation can get even better than that. Okay, so the bottom line is that we've got good classical algorithms to solve these same problems. So if you're just talking about estimation, then you know this boson computer doesn't seem to be doing anything useful. It's not giving you any speed up over what you can do classically. Okay, so the crucial step that we take in this work is to sort of change the notion of what we mean by a computational problem. Okay, so now we're actually going to talk about instead. So here are some classes of decision problems. You know that BPP is what you can do with an efficient randomized algorithm. BQP is what you can do with an efficient quantum algorithm. And there's these other like sharp P to the sharp P that encodes the difficulty of counting problems. Okay, and then there's some other classes like NP. Or actually, I want to talk about BPP with an oracle for NP. Okay, and that certainly contains the NP complete problems like 3SAT, for example. And then there's this big generalization of NP, which is called the polynomial hierarchy. Okay, where instead of just asking, does there exist a string of bits that satisfies these constraints, you can ask, does there exist a string X such that for every string Y, there exists a string Z such that yada yada, right? And you can have alternating universal and existential quantifiers. Okay, so these are, you know, there are at least 500 more complexity classes that I know about. These are a few of them. And in this work, we're not going to talk about any of those. Instead, we're going to talk about, instead of decision problems or estimation problems, we'll talk about sampling problems. Okay, so we'll talk about the class of probability distributions that you can sample from, either exactly or approximately, using a polynomial time classical algorithm, and then the class of distributions that you can sample using a polynomial time quantum algorithm. We can call those SAMP-P and SAMP-BQP. Okay, and now we can actually relate these two different sort of worlds of complexity, and you'll see, I'll prove later, that actually if all the quantum sampling problems could be solved on a classical computer, that would actually imply that P to the sharp P would collapse with BPP to the NP. Okay, if you don't know what that means, you can take my word for it that it's bad. Okay, you know, again, we don't know that they're different. It's just a belief, but you know, it's you know, like there are beliefs and beliefs, right? This is the type of you know belief where you know, it's more likely that aliens will storm the room, right, and take all of us hostage. Okay, so in particular, if BPP to the NP equaled P to the sharp P, you know, then what that would mean is that this polynomial hierarchy would collapse to a finite level. Okay, which is sort of not quite, wouldn't quite imply that P equaled NP. Okay, but it would mean that at some higher level of the hierarchy, you would basically get an analog to P equals NP. Okay, so it's, you know, so we many times in complexity we say such and such is probably true because if it were false, polynomial hierarchy would collapse. Okay, so that's what we're doing here. Okay, and in fact, if you don't like sampling problems, so I have a paper from this year where I sort of motivated by this work, where I show that you can also talk about search problems, problems where you have to output a string with a specified property. In fact, given any sampling problem whatsoever, you can define a search problem, which in some sense is equivalent to the sampling problem. And the way you do it is you say, output a string which has, or output a collection of strings which have large support in this probability distribution, and which also, conditioned on that, have close to maximal Kolmogorov complexity. Okay, so in other words, there should be no shorter description of these strings. They should be sort of algorithmically random, right, or incompressible. Okay, and you can actually prove that if you have a Turing machine and it's generating strings with close to maximal Kolmogorov complexity, then it can only be doing so by sampling them randomly. Okay, because otherwise that Turing machine would itself give you a succinct description of the strings. Okay, so fine. All right, so let me say, what is our computational model? So in this boson computer, it's a particular type of quantum computer where the basis states consists of just lists of non-negative integers, say S1 up to SM, where SI represents the number of bosons in the ith mode. I just think of as the ith bucket. Okay, so you know, we have the buckets, these yellow circles are the bosons. Okay, and we're never going to create or destroy them. So S1 up to SM, they always sum to n. Okay, the n is the number of bosons. All right, our standard initial state just has one boson in each of the first n modes, and then the remaining modes are unoccupied. Okay, now what you get to do in this model is apply any m by m unitary matrix U that you like, which mixes the m modes. Now the question is, what does U actually do? Because here we're not just talking, okay, if there was just one boson, it would be pretty clear what it does, but here there is n bosons. So what does it do? It turns out that U, if you consider the Hilbert space of all of the n photon states, then U induces via homomorphism a unitary phi of U on that larger space, and the entries of phi of U are defined by permanence of various submatrices of your original unitary U. Okay, this is also a representation of the M by M unitary group. So fine, whatever. Okay, so simple example of this experimentally is the Hongo-Mandel dip. So you just have this 2x2 unitary matrix, the Hadamard matrix, and when you apply it to two bosons, one of them in each of two modes, what you find is that clusters the bosons. So sometimes they'll both end up in the first mode, sometimes they both end up in the second, but they never land in different modes. And why is that? Well, you know, in terms of the permanent, the explanation is simple. It's that the amplitude for the bosons to land in separate modes has two contributions, right, corresponding to the two diagonals of this matrix. Okay, and they cancel each other out. Or in other words, just the permanent of the Hadamard matrix is zero. Okay, and that's why it doesn't happen. Okay, and you get a half probability for both bosons in the first mode, half probability for both in the second. All right, so for the card-carrying physicists in the audience, that means you. So our model experimentally would correspond to what's called linear optics. So where you would generate a single photon input states. Okay, it's important that they really be a single photon on demand and not like a coherent state. And then you would pass the photons through some network of beam splitters and phase shifters and sort of passive optical elements. And then you would have non-adaptive photon number measurements that measure the number of photons in each mode. Okay, so basically we're asking experimentalists to perform the n photon generalization of the Hongo-Mandel dip, where n is as large as you can make it. And our main results strongly suggest that that sort of generalized Hongo-Mandel dip, you know, for a large n, could refute the extended Church-Turing thesis. In other words, solve some sampling problem which is intractable classically. Okay, now, you know, there's a lot of challenges in actually doing the experiment. You need reliable single photon sources, many of you know is a hard problem, reliable photodetector arrays. And then you need a good probability of all n of the photons getting to the detectors at the same time. Okay, if they get there at different times, then they become distinguishable particles. And then, you know, nothing, and then it doesn't work. Yeah?
Do you mean on demand single photon sources?
Yes.
Or single photon sources?
Yeah, well, right. Well, if the trouble is, if it's a heralded single photon, then, you know, you need n of them simultaneously. And so then, you know, the naively, just the probability of all of them, you know, coming out when you want them would decrease exponentially with n. Then that's the problem that you got to get around somehow. So, yeah. Okay, non-adaptive means that you just, at the end, you just make the measurements and that's it. So you're not going to condition later actions on the outcomes of the measurements. Okay, so if you know the KLM scheme, so there's this scheme for universal quantum computation with linear optics, but it requires adaptive measurements. Okay, you have to make measurements in the middle and then decide what to do based on what you see. And we're not assuming that ability. All right, so yeah, so the physicists we consulted said, yes, you know, not surprisingly, this sounds hard, but, you know, possibly not quite as hard as building a universal quantum computer. So that's that made us happy. But, you know, as an amusing remark is that I don't think there's much point in scaling this experiment, you know, to huge numbers of photons, like 100 or 1,000, because at that point, a classical computer can't even verify the answer, okay? Your experiment might be working well, but you would never even know, because, you know, this is not an NP problem like factoring, where you can check the answer, right? We don't know how to check the answer, except by brute forcing it, okay? But I think already with 20 or 30 photons, if you can, you know, do the calculation faster with a quantum computer than with your classical computer, you know, that's already that extremely interesting. Okay. All right. So if I have 2 minutes or something, okay. I wanted to say, why is it hard to sample the distribution over photon numbers classically? Okay. Well, here's the main point. If I give you any n by n matrix A, you can certainly embed some rescaled version of A into a unitary matrix, a simple linear algebra fact. And then if you can construct a linear optical experiment where you would apply some sequence of beam splitters that, you know, induces that U, and then you look at what is the probability of observing some particular basis state, and you find, using that permanent formula that I showed you before, that the probability is just the absolute square of the permanent of A times some scaling factor, which you know. Okay, so, you know, this looks good if, you know, because we know permanent is sharp P hard, you know, so computing the probability of an outcome of this experiment is sharp P hard. Okay, the problem is this probability is exponentially small. Okay, so what are we going to do about that? All right, well, so there are sort of two claims. The first claim is that even if you just want to estimate P to within some multiplicative constant, that's already a sharp P hard problem. Okay, that's pretty easy to prove by sort of standard classical complexity reductions. Okay, so I won't go into that. Now, the second claim is the interesting one, is that suppose that you had a fast classical algorithm that sampled from the same distribution as the boson computer. Okay, then I claim that you could actually estimate the probability P in the class BPP with NP oracle. Okay, so you couldn't quite do it efficiently, but you could do it in this, like using an NP oracle. And the way you do it uses a well-known trick in classical complexity theory from the 80s, which is called approximate counting. Okay, basically, you know, you have your classical, let M be your classical sampling algorithm. And as a classical algorithm, it just takes as input some random sequence of bits. And based on that random sequence R, it outputs a sample, right? So now you can say, for what fraction of random input strings R does M output the basis state you care about? Okay, and now this is an approximate counting problem. It's still a problem involving summing exponentially many terms, right? Because there's exponentially many of these R's. Okay, but the crucial point is that now these are all non-negative terms. Okay, because these are all probabilities. Probabilities are non-negative. And to complexity theorists, you know, summing exponentially many complex numbers and summing exponentially many non-negative real numbers, they're both hard problems, but they're very, very different kinds of hard problem. Okay, one is sharp P, the other is BPP to the NP. And that's what, you know, gives us the magic. Okay, so in particular, we can obtain that if we had a fast classical algorithm for linear optic sampling, then P to the sharp P would equal BPP to the NP, which would collapse the whole polynomial hierarchy. All right. So there's an elephant in the room, which, you know, maybe it'll have to stay and hidden, you know, to the extent an elephant can. So, you know, everything hinged on the difficulty of estimating a single exponentially small probability. Okay, and you could say, what about if there's noise and there's error in your experiment? Then isn't that going to destroy the whole result? Okay, well, the answer is yes, it will. So that's why most of the technical work that we do in the paper is devoted to getting around this issue. Okay, so we say, look, the right question to ask is, how hard is it to sample from some distribution which is close to the quantum mechanical distribution? Okay, because not even the, you know, physical experiment itself can sample exactly from exactly the right distribution, right? So you know, allow some noise and some error. You know, our main result is that even this problem is hard, assuming that a BPP to the NP machine cannot estimate the permanent of a Gaussian random matrix with high probability. Okay, now this is not a conjecture that I would bet everything I have on, okay, but I think it's a plausible one. So this is our, you know, in fact, we believe that this should be, even this should be a Sharpie hard problem, in which case even a noisy Hong-Mandel experiment with N photons could falsify the extended Church-Turing thesis. So we spend a lot of effort trying to give evidence for this conjecture. We can prove it if you replace estimating by calculating, or most by all. A first step to proving it would be to understand the distribution of the permanent of a Gaussian random matrix. This is already an interesting problem where the full distribution, you know, even is not known. So the KLM theorem is a closely related result. I already said something about it, so I think I'll skip it unless there are questions about it. So open problems, prove the conjecture. You know what? Make it $1,000. Prove these are our conjectures. Basically, our main conjecture that this estimation problem is Sharpie hard. We can decompose it into two sub-conjectures. But can our model solve any classically intractable decision problem as opposed to a sampling problem? Okay, and can you get similar hardness results for other quantum systems? So what about topological quantum field theories? You know, right, the field is open. There was a very nice independent result of ours due to Bremner, Joza, and Shepard, where they looked at quantum computers with commuting Hamiltonians, which is another kind of non-universal quantum computer, but they proved a hardness of sampling result, which was analogous to ours. Maybe the big most exciting question for this crowd would be, can you actually do fault tolerance within this non-interacting boson model? Okay, so you know, if you can do adaptive measurements, then the answer is yes, you can. But without assuming that ability, you know, is there a way to sort of make the experiment that we're proposing resilient to error? And already some experimental groups have expressed interest in doing the experiment with four photons or so. So it's a start, and so I'm hoping that it'll lead somewhere. So thank you. So. Yes.
Mm-hmm. And Michael Douglas argued that the finding the right vacuum for nature was going to escape the vacuum car.
Yeah, no, I know the paper.
I was wondering whether you propose a single photon kind of experiment, but then at the end of the day you're interested in looking at distributions of how those come out. Is there a problem with just having a whole rush of photons at the same time? In other words, just having light shining on a diffractive medium with interference and having that be the problem? Or does somehow the many photons screw something up?
Right. Okay, well, first of all, to clarify, what we're asking for is sort of N photons, you know, one in each mode, right, which are generated on demand. Okay, so you need a large number of photons, but you need them in different modes and sort of one per mode, right?
Okay, so a distribution of occupancy.
So if you, well, okay, what we can say for sure is that if you had coherent states as your input, so like the output of a laser where the number of photons were Poisson distributed, right, then you can actually give an efficient classical algorithm to simulate the experiment. And so then there's no possibility of getting a speed up of the kind that we're talking about. Okay, if you had, let's say you had reliably 10 photons per mode, exactly 10, no more and no less, right? Then probably you could solve a hard problem. You know, you would need to make a slightly different conjecture. You know, you would need to do a new analysis, basically. But
classical light.
Yes.
Eliminates the hard part.
Yeah, exactly. It is interesting. It's amazing. Yeah.
Maybe better call it.
Okay.
But
okay. Yeah, sure.